We welcome you to International Edition from the Voice of America, and we begin with breaking news coming out of Nice, France. There are unconfirmed reports that a large vehicle, a truck, has plowed into a crowd that was dispersing following Bastille Day celebrations in the city of Nice. The truck apparently has rammed into that crowd. There are reports that at least 30 people are dead, more than 100 are injured. And there are also reports of gunfire following that incident. All of this is still being sorted out as authorities and news reports continue to come to us from that coastal city in France. And a lot of the details remain unclear at this time. But we will remain on top of the story and bring you more information as it does come in. And we also invite you to go to our website, voanews.com, for the latest updates. And we will also be updating on social media via Twitter and Facebook. Well, coming up, the U.S. Republican presidential conventions are going to be taking place in Cleveland, Ohio. Presumptive nominee Donald Trump about to pick his vice presidential nominee. And to discuss that, we invite VOA's Jim Malone in the studio to tell us more about what Mr. Trump may be doing just ahead of the convention.
The timing is within the bounds of what they normally do, and Trump will make the announcement 11 a.m. Monday in New York City. We sort of have a sense of the finalists here. As of later on Thursday, you know, the favorite, if there is one, seems to be Indiana Governor Mike Pence. We'll see if that pans out. Pence is a traditional conservative. He served 6 terms in the House, sort of a pre-Tea Party conservative, if you will, close to evangelical or Christian voters. So it looks as though a Pence pick would sort of shore up Trump's links with conservatives in the Republican Party, and there has been some issues there. It's probably a smart pick, if it is him, to try to unify the party on the eve of the convention.
That's essentially what we've heard Trump's aim is to find somebody who can help him actually govern if he is elected.
Yes, he has talked about that in the past because he certainly acknowledges he has no governmental experience in terms of holding office. Pence, as a House member and as a governor, certainly can cite that. I was looking through his background. Pence wrote an article or an essay, I think in the early 90s, how he had decided to swear off negative campaigning. We'll see how that works out if it goes ahead on that, because by all accounts, this upcoming general campaign is going to be very negative.
It's a bit of a delicate selection if you think about it. I mean, you want somebody who projects the air of stability. And on the other hand, he's got to be almost a bit of an attack dog, or at least go along with what Trump is saying. And that could be a little problematic.
Yeah, and you know, certainly one of the supposed contenders we've heard about, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, is not one to shy away from the campaign fight. You know, when you look at Donald Trump, he's made his reputation as a politician as an attack dog. He almost doesn't need a surrogate attack dog. He'll do very well, thank you very much, himself on that score.
What's the probable effect for Hillary Clinton's campaign once she now knows who Donald Trump's ticket is going to entail?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, she has her own calculations to make about a running mate that might then factor into who the Democrats might want to run with her. You know, my own feeling is someone like a Christie, who's a controversial figure. He has some critics in the Republican Party don't think he's controversial or conservative enough. But Christie might have that ability to reach out to more moderate voters or swing voters. Pence is not going to excite a lot of people, I don't think, in the middle. There's polling that shows he doesn't add that much to the ticket, so it seems more of a shoring up on the conservative side. It might allow Clinton to think about, you know, a little bit more of a bolder choice. But from everything we've heard, she's approaching it in a fairly conservative way about who she'd like to pick. And one of the leading contenders on the Democratic side is Senator Tim Kaine from Virginia. Not a lot of Democrats might get excited about that, but he's considered a moderate.
We tend to get excited about the vice presidential picks, obviously. But how about the voters at large when it comes to November and they're pulling the levers and punching the tickets? Are they really paying attention to the vice presidents?
Yeah, not a lot. That's right. You know, the classic case of a pick who probably made a difference, you have to go back really to 1960 when John Kennedy, a Democrat, picked Lyndon Johnson as his vice president, helped him carry Texas and a few other southern states, and it was a close election, so it did matter. Most of the time since then, it's not been that much of a help. It's always seen as a crucial first choice for a presidential nominee to make, though, so voters do remember it.
We're always thankful for the insight of Jim Malone. Jim's going out to the conventions in Cleveland, and best of luck to you out there. It should be interesting.
It should be. I'm sure we'll be talking. And, yeah, I think the Cleveland Week in particular coming up next week is going to be fascinating.
Thanks so much for stopping by, Jim.
You bet.
Well, we check now the unwavering popularity of Pokemon Go. It's a mobile game that's sweeping the country by storm, and International Edition's social media guru G. Abby Lee is right here in the studio with the latest on the game. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. Unless you've been living under a rock, you know about Pokemon Go. Of course, you have heard about it.
Oh,
yes.
We
talked about it a lot outside of the studio. It's an augmented reality game, and those of our listeners who are not in this part of the world, I can explain that you're a trainer, and then you have to catch little creatures to train them. So you first have to go somewhere to catch them, and then they're captured in a little ball, and then you just collect them. And the places you can catch them are called either a Pokestop or a gym, because you're a trainer, you go to a gym to train.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's a reality game, you have to actually get outside and walk around to catch them. And that's why some people say it may be leading to some good exercise for some people.
Well, I've definitely seen a lot of people glued to their cell phones, walking around with their eyes transfixed, and it wasn't just texting or watching YouTube.
That's right. But there's reportedly a new sponsorship that may be offsetting the physical exercise some gamers have gained from Pokemon Go. The buzz is that some internet users found code earlier this week that indicates a potential sponsorship between McDonald's and Pokemon Go. That's right, the global hamburger chain, and Gizmodo was first to report on this possibility. So what is the deal? It's about every McDonald's location in one Asian country serving as either a Pokestop or a gym, and it's unsure which country it will be yet, but a lot of people are guessing Japan.
Well, that kind of makes sense. That was the birthplace of Pokemon,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's right. And it's also worth noting that Pokemon Go game hasn't even launched in Japan yet, which was quite surprising to me because naturally you think Pokemon Japan, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Well, what's the public's reaction like to Pokemon?
Well, many people quip that it's a bit of a contradiction that a quote-unquote training game is sponsored by a fast food chain, often criticized for being part of America's obesity problem. But some came to McDonald's defense, writing, "It's not the restaurant that's making people fat, it's overeating that makes people fat." Another person wrote, "McDonald's is going to be telling people that Pokemon are in their Happy Meal." Jim, back to you.
All right, it'll make him very happy. Thank you, G. G. Abby Lee, you may follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm out there as well at VOA Stevenson. And be sure to stop by the International Edition feed. That's at VOA_IE. Among the top stories trending at this hour in Asia, suspect in Cambodia, Khem Lay murder, could face life in prison. Congress urged to cut off financial and military aid to Pakistan. China hardens position against Hong Kong booksellers. Thousands of Afghan children working in hazardous conditions, according to Human Rights Watch. U.S. judge sentences Chinese national in military hacking case. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at a website, voanews.com, and on our VOA mobile app. Also, be sure to follow breaking news from France, that deadly truck collision with the holiday crowd in Nice. It's all online. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. The Philippines Foreign Ministry on Thursday called on China to respect Wednesday's landmark ruling by the Permanent Court of Arbitration, rejecting Beijing's claim of sovereignty over most of the South China Sea. RAND Corporation political scientist Scott Harrell tells VOA's Victor Beatty that Washington's also trying to defuse the idea in Beijing that the ruling is part of a U.S. effort to isolate China.
I think the U.S. is looking to try to signal to China that the U.S. expects China to live up to and adhere to international law and to abide by the rulings, but that this is not part of a broader signal that the U.S. is looking to line up countries in the region in a permanent coalition to oppose China on all fronts, on all issues. However, I do think that it is the case that in almost every country in the Asia Pacific, the reality is most of these countries regard the ruling as a good thing because it signals that China's ambitious nine-dash-line claim to the entirety of the South China Sea has been denied and given a forceful rejection by the international legal system. And it will impose costs on China if China chooses to stay outside of that system. I think the debate in the U.S. right now, as I understand it, is between those who think that the best approach is to give Beijing the space to reach the conclusion that it needs to find an off-ramp by which it can begin to move itself into accord with international legal norms, and those who think that China has painted itself into this corner and that it should not be given any opportunity to wiggle out of having to live up to those commitments, and that if you signal that there's something like a China exception whereby this ruling's impact can be muted or ignored for some period of time or even altogether, then you're really running a substantial risk by giving China the signal that the U.S. is not fully pushing for this.
Do you anticipate a reassessment within Chinese circles?
Well, the Chinese have been very smart in the past, and at times they have reassessed. In the wake of the Taiwan Strait crisis from 1995-1996, they moved to address the concerns that the region expressed about a China threat and engaged in a lengthy decade-long charm offensive with Southeast Asia. We saw in late 2013 an attempt to reassure the region after China's initial bout of assertiveness with Xi Jinping going around the region, Li Keqiang going around the region, and a big foreign affairs conference that sought to reemphasize the importance of good neighbor diplomacy. But almost immediately that was followed with additional instances of assertiveness or even aggression against neighbors, intimidation, and of course the late 2013 announcement of an air defense identification zone in the East China Sea. So while they've clearly been flexible in their tactics and dialed down assertiveness at times when it seemed to be in their interest to do so, the Chinese leadership has also found that it's pretty attractive to return to that position from time to time and pretty quickly. So I would assess that it's unlikely that they will completely repudiate the approach that's so clearly tied to Xi Jinping and Hu Jintao before him.
Scott Harrell with the RAND Corporation. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson have pledged to work closely together as NATO allies to address challenges and meet responsibilities around the world. VOA's Jamie Detmer shares perspective on Boris Johnson's surprise appointment with International Edition host Ira Melman.
There's a lot of incredulity about the appointment of Boris Johnson, and really I suppose one could sum it up as a pooled surprise. Both in the UK and across Europe, not just Schultz. The French Foreign Minister has said that Johnson's a liar, for example, there are a lot of jokes about the appointment. He is a man who isn't noted for his diplomatic language. But there may be a logic in this. I mean, conservative insiders say to me that if you look at what she's done, not just with Boris Johnson, who is a Brexiteer, but also the appointment of the International Trade Secretary being Liam Fox, who's also a Brexiteer, and the appointment of David Davis as the minister who's going to be in charge of negotiating the exit from the European Union. The logic isn't just about a kind of facile internal party dynamic here. She's really brought in the Brexiteers, some would argue, to give her cover. Part of the thrust may well be they were the ones who broke it, so they're the ones who are going to have to live with it and repair and salvage what can be done out of the Brexit referendum.
And what about Boris Johnson overall as Foreign Secretary? With some of the things he has said about other leaders, including Western leaders, including the U.S. president, how does he come off of that to getting into a role of a foreign minister?
Well, that's what I think is the biggest gamble. At this level of politics, I think there can be recovery in terms of relationships. Boris is a very charming man. He'll be dealing directly, obviously, with U.S. diplomats and European diplomats. He will be kept away from Brexit negotiations, interestingly. I think there'll have to be a big effort by Boris to zip up a little bit, be more careful what he says in the future, and to use that charm to overcome some of the offense he's caused to European and American politicians. One interesting area that hasn't had so much coverage is Syria policy. He has, you know, in the last few months, really focused on saying that we should be defeating ISIS, and that may well mean helping President Assad. You know, obviously, the Syrian rebels are appalled at the appointment of Boris Johnson and see that as a danger for them. But I think that probably he'd be slapped down on that, and may well have him following British government policy.
VOA's Jamie Detmer, and you can find more on this story at our website, voanews.com. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This is VOA's International Edition. Oscar winners Matt Damon, Tommy Lee Jones, Alicia Vikander, and they all star in the latest installment of the Jason Bourne thriller series, Jason Bourne. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us in this film, Bourne knows who he is, and he's seeking to fill in the details of his past.
I remember. I remember everything.
Remembering everything doesn't mean you know everything.
Tell me.
Matt Damon returns as the $100 million weapon Jason Bourne. This time, Jason resurfaces several years after the last film in the series, 2007's The Bourne Ultimatum. Jason spends his days pounding other humans into submission in bare-knuckle fights. But then Bourne sets out to find out the truth behind his training and his life. Nikki Parsons, played by Julia Stiles, who might be Jason Bourne's only friend in the world, tracks him down to tell the whole story before she exposes the CIA Operation Treadstone, the assassin program that trained Jason Bourne. Matt Damon, who first embodied the character in 2002's The Bourne Identity, says he jumped at the chance to work with British director Paul Greengrass, who directed two previous Bourne films.
Well, a few things. One, the world had really changed significantly from 2007 when our last movie came out, and the other most significant factor was that Paul Greengrass wanted to do it, and that, you know, that was always my number one ask of this whole process was, could Paul be involved? And as long as he felt there was a movie to make, I knew we could come up with a good one.
Damon had to bulk up to play the character again, going on a strict diet, working out with weights 4 days a week, and doing cardio exercises every day. But Matt says the routine was punishing but effective.
When I started playing this character, I was 29 years old, and I mean, I'd go out running after work. I'd run right along the Seine, and it was really great. And you know, but now it's like two workouts a day and very specific diet, and it's a little harder now at 45.
Tommy Lee Jones plays CIA Director Robert Dewey, while Alicia Vikander plays CIA super hacker Heather Lee. Vikander says that acting on a Bourne film allowed her to work in a series that she's been a fan of.
Of course, the scale of it, and I think the most surreal thing is more that I've been such a fan of the franchise. So when you got on set the first day, I got to step into a film I've been a big fan of, and that was pretty surreal.
Vincent Cassell plays The Asset, an assassin who's sent after Jason Bourne. Cassell says the action thriller offers fans what they have come to expect: tension, excitement, and, of course, lots of martial arts, gunplay, and explosions.
It seems like in this movie, nobody really speaks a lot, you know, or we give a lot of information. I mean, it's really about a chase, so the information has to go roll, you know, so it's a lot of cuts. It's that kind of movie. I mean, it looks beautiful. It's really powerful. I think that's the goal, right?
Fans can look for plenty of excitement in this film, including a massive car chase on the Las Vegas Strip that involved ramming the Riviera Casino with a SWAT vehicle. 170 cars were destroyed shooting the scene. Jason Bourne is rated PG-13 for violence and language. It opens in U.S. theaters July 29th. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. Find us on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you so much for joining us today. Come back when you can and have a wonderful day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The shea tree is a traditional African food plant. Today, it has many commercial uses: increased trade in shea products benefiting the economies of many African nations will be the result of a $13 million 5-year agreement signed this month in Accra, Ghana, between the Global Shea Alliance, or GSA, and the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, to promote shea markets worldwide and improve sustainable production in Africa. The shea industry is changing, and companies, governments, and donors are investing more in sustainable production and improving the benefit to 16 million women collectors and processors, says Mumuni Konate, president of the Global Shea Alliance. The goal of this critical partnership is to help women collectors and processors organize into cooperatives, obtain equipment and training, and improve the financial benefit from the sale of their products. Stronger and more profitable women's groups will process more shea, improve quality, and protect the trees. During the Global Shea Alliance's annual conference in Accra, Ghana, USAID West Africa Mission Director Alex Deprez said, "We know well the benefits of increased trade for rural communities across Africa." The partnership will match up to $6.5 million in USAID funds, with $6.5 million in private sector funding raised by the GSA to implement promotional and sustainability activities in Benin, Burkina Faso, Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, Mali, and Nigeria. These activities include launching research projects to improve shea tree planting materials, supporting tree planting campaigns and improved management of parklands, launching resource conservation projects to reduce wood and water use, hosting annual conferences and exhibitions in Africa, the United States, and the European Union, constructing 250 warehouses, health and safety initiatives, improving financial benefits by 50%, and providing capacity building and training for 137,500 women shea collectors and processors, and a variety of other international engagements to grow shea markets worldwide. The GSA is pioneering efforts to grow markets and improve the livelihoods of rural women and their families that stand at the base of the shea value chain, said USAID West Africa Mission Director Deprez. We are proud to partner in these activities.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.